Taboule, Rocheru, Rocheru, and Afrisa International. Then we Shikamu Jazzbus before that. And that about does it for this Friday's edition of Radio Free Chico. Stay tuned for Peace and Social Justice. Chris Nelson will be your host today. I'll see you next week. Thanks for tuning in. Bye-bye.
But you never go away, so I guess I gotta stay now. Oh, I hope someday I'll make it out of here, even if it takes a night or a hard day. Here's no place to hide, but I can't find. Skinned upon, hello, welcome home.
Walking out of town,
walking out of town,
looking for a better place,
better place.
Sometimes on my mind,
something's on my mind.
Always in my head's back.
But I know someday I'll make it.
Welcome home to all of us. The song is called Lovely. It's Billie Eilish and Khalid in the One Voice Children's Choir. And my name is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. We're here with you every Friday from 11:30 to 1. And I'm very pleased to welcome my first guest today. She's an old friend and someone who's doing phenomenal work in our community. Her name is Anicia Johnson. She's a lifelong resident of Chico and identifies herself as a foundational Black American of Native and African ancestries. Born at Enloe Hospital in 1961, she and her younger siblings attended preschool through university in their hometown, graduating with degrees in economics, communications, social work, and international business. This is a staggering statistic in a community with a 2% Black population. Anicia's love of world cultures, beginning with her own African and Native or Indigenous heritage, has been the inspiration for the creation of a cultural center of learning and entertainment in her hometown of Chico, as well as outreach to youth in Northern California, AMA Culture, Education, Sciences, and Arts. Anicia is the daughter of Dorothy Johnson, for whom the city's recreation center is named. Welcome to the Peace and Justice Program, Anicia.
Thank you very much, Chris.
Yeah, and I look back on an interview you did in June with my co-host, Corey Hunt, and he did such a beautiful job of talking with you, and I just want to start with some of the issues that you both talked about. We mentioned in your introduction that you and your siblings are amazing, and the fact that you came up through a almost totally white environment in Chico and all graduated from Chico State, and your degree is in international business. But when you graduated college, only three people in your graduating class of 500 were black. And at that time, from what you said, you didn't really understand about institutional racism in 1987. How has that, how have you changed or grown or evolved with the time since then and since your childhood here in Chico?
Well, yes, not really understanding what I was up against, what I would be coming up against as an adult, has been very challenging, and many opportunities for growth and deepening my awareness of my spiritual nature and ability to progress in the face of social hostility. So there's been a lot of growth, I'll just put it that way.
Yeah. And the thing that you've done with AMA Culture, which you founded in 2017, I believe it was, this has been an amazing undertaking, and I was wondering if you could describe why you formed it and what your goals are with AMA Culture.
Okay, yes. Growing up black in Chico, the black population has traditionally been 2%, and it doesn't change much from that. But my experience growing up here was I grew up in the area of town that some people call Chapman Town. And in our neighborhood, just growing up, it was just our neighborhood. I didn't even know it was referred to as Chapman Town. But that's where a lot of the working class, black, white, Latino, a few Native Americans lived when I was growing up in the 60s and 70s. But I wasn't aware that we were so few in the town overall until my adult years. But growing up, I had this feeling in hindsight, I can say, of being brought up under the loving wings of a collective family of young black families, parents, who had migrated from the rural South, different places in the South. My parents had come from the cotton fields of Texas, literally. Mm-hmm. But growing up, I just always had this sense that there were elders around me who cared whether I was walking to or from school. And particularly, I have this sense of it leaving our neighborhood and going to the junior high school, where we would meet with other people from other neighborhoods. And I just always had this feeling that there were eyes and, caring hearts attending us. And as an adult, and especially now as a grandparent, I began looking around thinking, well, I want something. First of all, I want our youth, all of our youth, to have this sense of belonging, that their culture and heritage is respected and understood. And so I came up with the idea of establishing a nonprofit that would help me and other caring community members do outreach to youth and young families, and also help facilitate educating people on the importance of African American history and its connection to ancient Africa and the African diaspora as well. So we, I founded Mama Culture in 2017, and we've done community gatherings that are always open to the public. If, programs in the school and local Boys and Girls Club. Our objective is to instill pride in and respect for the African diaspora, and an overall goal of mitigating issues within the Black community by helping instill pride and a sense of cultural identity, but also to help students stay more engaged in their education, and also to create more understanding and harmony between all demographics of people. So we're doing it through community events, like I said, that are open to the public, as well as education presentations, either in the schools or clubs and organizations or any place that would like to have us.
It brings up a lot of questions for me. It's been many years since I've had a child in an elementary school, and I know your goal is to get with children early so that you can address miseducation. And I was wondering, have you been looking into what the schools are teaching now in regard to African history and the African-American or Black experience in the United States? Is it still kind of ignored, except for some short bit about slavery and the Emancipation Proclamation and that? I mean, is it still just sort of touched on? Do you know?
That's typical. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's what most of us learn.
Right.
Growing up is that, you know, let's see. When I was growing up in the 60s, it was Black history, I think, still. Mm-hmm. And I just remember being taught that our history began with slavery. We were slaves.
Yeah.
Or, you know, primitive people that were, you know, made slaves. And so there's been a whole systemic disregarding an ancient African history, which is the history of African Americans. And I would venture to say that it's a deliberate design of systems that maintain a status quo when children are not taught about the greatness, the great achievements of their ancient past, and are only shown problems here in the United States and struggle, it's going to have a negative impact on who they think they are and what their potential is. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I do find, though, that the educators are very open to learning and are really excited when I come in and have my presentation for the children. The teachers are on the side going, I didn't know that, which doesn't surprise me at all. Mm-hmm. But it's enlightening. It's enlightening to find out about the past contributions of people throughout the globe that are of African descent.
And it's so important. I mean, it is just so critical for young people's development. I'm wondering, how have you been received in the schools? You say that the people that have heard you are enthusiastic and excited and also learn as teachers, but how often are you invited into the schools here in Butte County?
Well, of course, with the new restrictions concerning COVID, it's been a lot more challenging. But I'm finding that some educators are figuring out ways that we can social distance and still get information to their students with the overall objective of meeting the underserved populations, and many of those are Black Americans. So I'm finding that there's a lot of opportunity there. Mm-hmm. We just need to get the word out.
Right. So one question I have is, how is it being taken in by the kids? What reflects back to you in the students? Do you get interest and excitement? I know history is kind of hard to teach. Are you finding that they have a little bells going off with this information?
Absolutely. We're called AMA Culture, Education, Sciences, and Arts, because we want to make sure that the children know that people of African ancestry, that their heritage involves all of these exciting areas of life. So it's really fun to see the dots connect for them. And I think of them as like myself when I was their age. There were things that I, questions that I had that weren't getting answered. And so, yeah, they're very excited. And like I said, some of the administrators and teachers are very happy that this resource is available, and that their students are going to, because of this experience with AMA Culture, come out feeling much better about themselves. And that's what we need for a healthier, happier society, is for everybody to feel good about who they are.
Yeah, definitely. So I know you've created a lot of visuals and you have installations. And how would teachers or homeschoolers get hold of you in order to schedule you to come into their classes?
Sure. We have a website, which is amaculture.org, AMMAculture.org. And I can be reached there. I also can be reached at 530-354-7018. And we are a fund of North Valley Community Foundation. There's an AMA fund there, and people can donate there as well. So lots of places you can find us.
And I see that you're doing a homeschool class on the 7th. Is that open to all homeschoolers or just to a certain a class?
It is available to anyone doing homeschool. Sure, yeah.
Okay. So, folks, this is the December 7th, 10 to 12. If you're homeschooling your kids, you definitely want to check this out. Anicia Johnson, I really appreciate your time today, and I would like to ask you about A Taste of Kwanzaa. Kwanzaa is a festival that really resonates for a lot of us because of the values that are shared, and I was wondering if you could tell us about your event and what will be happening there on December 26th at the Women's Club.
Okay, yes. On December 26th, we're having a short afternoon program and gathering, which we call A Taste of Kwanzaa, because as many people know, Kwanzaa is traditionally celebrated or observed over a 7-day period beginning the day after Christmas, December 26th. And each day of Kwanzaa is devoted to a character building, or I call community building value, so that they're called the seven principles of Kwanzaa. And what we're going to do is just highlight those principles and have some activities and a little bit of music, a skit to help explain it and the history. And it'll just be a fun, again, community gathering, always family-oriented. And it's from 2 to 4 at the Chico Women's Club on December 26th.
And that, it really sounds great. And it's open to everybody. And also, I wanted to also let our listeners know that from your website, I learned that everything you're doing with kids is free to the kids. And so how, you said you're part of North Valley Community Foundation. Are you having to survive just on donations, or do you have some grant funding, or how are you getting, how is it going?
We're still surviving on donations.
Okay.
And seeking more funding at this time. Our events pay for themselves, but there's a suggested donation for adults, and we're anticipating that we'll get that significant funding very soon to keep us going, so that we can do these ongoing events. And also our we have another short-range goal of having an office and a center of learning in Chico.
Oh, that'd be great. That'd be really great. So kids could just come in there. That'd be wonderful. I see, too, you had a African Diaspora Celebration Day, October 17th, and over 50 people showed up, as all three generations, children, parents, grandparents.
There were 50 children.
50 children.
And parents.
Plus the parents.
And grandparents and other people from the community. It was fabulous.
And
the parents told me afterwards that many of the children were asking to do it again.
Oh.
So my vision of having these social opportunities for children to see the larger community coming out to celebrate their heritage, it really has manifested into that. And that's what makes my heart sing, is that these children feel even more valued because of these experiences. And our events are not just for children to learn. We're all learning. So, everybody benefits.
Definitely. Definitely. It's so great. And I suppose in January you'll be part of the Martin Luther King Jr. celebrations that we have every year here in Chico. Is it too early to ask about that?
No. I'm not sure if you're aware that it's virtual now.
It was last year, yeah.
Yeah, so there will be various organizations and businesses and community people that are highlighted during this online celebration. So I'm definitely part of that.
I look forward to it, even though they did a great job last year, but it was still not the same as being in the church with the whole community and, you know, the acoustics of the church at Trinity Methodist is so lovely. So, I'm glad that, you know, it's very inclusive when you do it online, because you can get a lot more people, a lot more settings, and it's very exciting how it happened last year. I hope people will get involved in that, but right now we don't have too much information on it. Anisha Johnson, you are you're a community educator and founder of AMMA Culture. I want to spell that AMMA. Culture, ammaculture.org. You can find out more information. But we have 2 minutes left, 3 minutes left, and I'd like you to be able to wrap up and say whatever I didn't ask you that you feel like is really important to get out to our listeners here on KZFR Peace and Justice Program.
Well, you know, I'll just add, as you know my family, and as you mentioned to your audience, I'm the daughter of Dorothy Johnson, for whom the local recreation center is named, and you also talked about the MLK event coming up. Well, I proudly stood in front of the Dorothy Johnson Center for the videoing of my portion for the celebration coming up in January, and I just like to acknowledge my parents, so many other elders in the community, you know, Joe and Pearl Person, the Jackson family, the Forest people that you guys wouldn't know necessarily, but many of them have gone to meet their maker. And, you know, it's on their shoulders that I do this work, and with great examples. So that would be all.
Yeah, and now we're that elder generation. Now we're the ones, you know. So I really appreciate that you have taken this path, and you know, your the path of your whole lifetime to lead you to this place of leadership, and you know, working with education, sciences, and arts for our children, our children's children, and as the case may be, and. So thank you so much for being my guest today, Anicia Johnson, on the Peace and Justice Program. And I hope folks will assist you in making this program institutionalized so that it stays strong.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate the opportunity, Chris.
All right. Peace to you.
Peace.
Bye-bye. All right. So Anicia Johnson, hard at work, educating children in an area that has been really neglected in our school system, unfortunately. And I wish, you know, I wish I really knew more about what is being taught in the school to our kids. It's so important that they get a comprehensive education. All right, I want to make an announcement. This is regarding the case of Tyler Rushing, who is a young man who was killed by Chico police. And the announcement reads, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued its ruling on 11:30. Right now, the legal team is putting together a strategy for the trial. A date has not been set. Overall, the ruling is a win for Tyler Rushing. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals reinstated the civil suit against the city of Chico and its police officers arising from the death of Tyler Rushing. The officers used a taser on Tyler after he was already badly wounded, ending his life. The appellate court held that the use of force was excessive and unreasonable. The court thus remanded the case to the district court for trial. Along with the federal excessive force claim, the appellate court also reinstated all state law claims against the Chico police officers, the Chico Police Department, and the City of Chico. Tyler Rushing can now have his day in court as Scott Rushing and his wife seek to vindicate Tyler and obtain some measure of justice for his unnecessary killing at the hands of the Chico Police Department. That's from his dad, Scott Rushing. And I think that this kind of lifts all boats. It gives hope to David Phillips, the father of Desmond Phillips also, and to hopefully other families who have lost loved ones at the hands of Chico Police Department. So just wanted to let you know that was happening. And if you would like to, you know, chime in, you can find out more information on at Concerned Citizens for Justice webpage here in Chico. I'd like to go ahead with a song, and then I'll get our next guest on the line. Actually, I shouldn't do that. That's a mistake. I should do the underwriters first. And I want to thank all of you who support KZFR in all the different ways that you do it, as volunteers, as contributors, or as underwriters. We always need help here at the station to keep ourselves vibrant and strong. So, first of all, I would like to thank Chico Performances, which is presenting a very Chico Nutcracker on Friday and Saturday and Sunday, December 3rd, 4th, and 5th at Loxon Auditorium. Backed by popular demand, Chico Community Ballet's newly envisioned A Very Chico Nutcracker returns to the stage, infusing the rich history of Chico into the traditional Nutcracker Ballet. Tickets at the University Box Office, 898-6333, or at chicoperformances.com. So that's this weekend. Don't miss out. And by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating over 100 years of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with the fabric of your choice right here in Chico. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue. For details, see squaredealmattress.com. And let's see. I think I'm a little bit off my range here. Would also like to thank the Regional and Continuing Education Center at Chico State, featuring online career training for jobs in the growing and in-demand fields of healthcare, construction, and trades, from medical billing and coding to HVAC technicians to veterinary assistants. There's a wide range of options, interests, and skill sets. Visit rce.csuchico.edu to learn more. And lastly, I'd like to thank Quicksilver Courier Service. Established in 2010, Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of delivery services for private individuals, as well as for legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit chicocourier.com for quality 24/7 delivery service. So it is 1 minute to the top of the hour here on Friday, December 3rd, and I would like to say that this is FM 90.1, KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers, just mine and my guests. And I appreciate having this venue to speak up about important issues. And with that, we're going to go on to the next interview. Let's have a little Nina Simone. Incomparable Nina Simone, and caught that little gender thing that about men being free. I think it's really important now, especially more than ever, that everyone's freedom is important. I have on the line with me an incredible person who has worked very hard over the years. I have Nick Moturn. He has worked as a reporter, researcher, writer, and political organizer over the last 40 years. Upon graduation from Wabash College in 1960, he joined the U.S. Navy, and he was stationed in Saigon, South Vietnam, early in the war there, where after leaving the Navy, he worked for nearly a year as a reporter for the English-language newspaper, the Saigon Post. In 1966, he graduated from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and then he was a reporter for the Providence, Rhode Island Journal and Evening Bulletin. He was a researcher and writer for the former U.S. Senate Select Committee on Nutrition and Human Needs, a lobbyist for Bread for the World, a writer and a co-organizer of speaking tours in the United States on U.S. military involvement in Africa and apartheid South Africa. And he worked, visited many African nations during that time, wrote a book called Suffering Strong, recounting his experiences in Africa. And So just jumping into the more present time, since 2010, he has worked with others in the U.S. who have been opposing U.S. drone attacks and drone warfare, creating first the website No Drones, that's K-N-O-W, drones, one word, which was devoted to anti-drone education and organizing in 2014. He started another one called Boycott and Divest Honeywell, which is www.badhoneywell.org, which you probably won't discuss today. But the reasoning was that Honeywell produces engines and other equipment for the Reaper drone, which is one of the worst of the drone killing machines. And in January 2021, he joined with other peace activists to co-found BanKillerDrones.org, which is an organization devoted to achieving an international treaty to ban weaponized drones and military and police drone surveillance. I want to welcome you, Nick Morton, to the Peace and Justice Program. Hi.
Yes. Hi, Chris. Thank you very much. I'm really very honored to be here.
Well, you know, I'm honored to get to meet you for the first time. I've been following your work for a long time, and it's important. You seem like you've been all over the place in terms of the work that you've been doing. And, you know, I interviewed Ray Acheson, who was very instrumental in the nuclear ban that that has been that is now into part of international law. And when I saw that there was a ban attempt for the what we call killer drones, I was excited. But I also know this is more difficult. I mean, we know nuclear weapons from Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and all, you know, it just goes back that all nations know that, you know, that nuclear weapons have to be banned because there's no winnable nuclear war. Whereas drones have really captured the imagination of people. They've been touted by the military. Their use is it's like a Pandora's box. Countries all over the world now want them, have them. There's, you know, they are growing by leaps and bounds around the world. So how do you think we can achieve a ban on military drones?
Well, it's, you know, that's a challenging question for us every day. I can tell you what I think a good part of the problem is, and I can tell you how we're going to try to approach this. On August 29th this year, 2021, a U.S. Reaper drone launched a Hellfire missile into the courtyard of a house in Kabul, Afghanistan, and slaughtered 10 family members of the Ahmadi family. Seven of those were children. What was so unusual about that attack was that it was done right under the noses of the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, CNN, a number of other journalists. And so they could go immediately to the site of that attack. They could try to document what really happened as opposed to what the U.S. military said happened. And the U.S. military was finally forced to acknowledge that this attack and these deaths were a big mistake. There has been no coverage of almost all drone attacks that have been conducted since 2001, the first day of the invasion by the U.S. of Afghanistan. During the Obama period, there was a surge in drone attacks. There was no real coverage of the consequences, just sporadic reports of atrocities. The Trump administration went further and killed more people. In Afghanistan, the Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates that at least 10,000 people have been killed by U.S. drone attacks. Had all of these attacks, or even half of them, been exposed to the kind of coverage, analysis, investigation as the one on August 29th. We might even have a ban against weaponized drones right now, because the history of this is to not only kill people without benefit of trial, but there have been huge mistakes. There was a government study conducted over a four-month period, I think it was in 2014 or 2015, where they found that 90% of the people who were killed by drone attacks by the U.S. were not the people targeted by those attacks.
Right.
The other part of it is that any of these attacks, you can imagine that if a missile came out of the sky in your neighborhood and killed even five or six people, two or three people. And you could still hear that airplane in the sky constantly. You'd be afraid to go outdoors. You'd be terrified. And the family members of the people killed, it would just be something that they couldn't comprehend in the sense of how does this happen that this eye in the sky is just coming, you know, here to kill us. So, because the public, the world public, the American public, have not been exposed to these realities, it's not the same as having viewed the effects of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and these other very terrifying pictures of nuclear explosions. How do we deal with that? We are doing several things. One, we've tried to have some webinars to educate people, not a lot of exposure to that. We also, there are 20-some drone attack bases inside the United States where people in National Guard and the Air Force control killer drones in other countries, you know, via satellite, another kind of communication. There are a number of people who protested at various bases, try to bring this to people's attention. One thing that we do hope to do, I'm not sure exactly when we can accomplish this, but we do hope to have an international drone war crimes tribunal. And that would be a place where, like other such tribunals, Bertrand Russell's tribunal on Vietnam, where people who had experienced drone attacks would come to testify, where there'd be experts in killer drone technology who would point out the shortcomings and the failures of this. There'd be people from international law, human rights law experience who would comment on it from that perspective. And we would try to identify people who have been responsible for these attacks, including President Obama, President Biden, because people need to be held responsible for these atrocities. Yeah. And so those are kind of what we're hoping for.
And I'm back to the end of the war in Afghanistan. There was a lot of focus at the time on the Ahmadi family because 10 members of their family were killed. 7 of them were children. And the Pentagon said they didn't do anything illegal when they killed them. And it appears that they're not going to give full reparations for the killing of this family, and perhaps not even assist them in passage to the United States. Can you give us an update about how much coverage is this getting now, and what can we be doing about that to help, even if it's just this one family against something that was so horrifying?
Yes. What people can do is to write to their, one thing they can do is to write to their member of Congress and demand reparations for the Ahmadi family. It's not clear that they have that that has been settled at this point. I've tried to, you know, find out about more about that in the last 2 days, and I haven't been able to find out about that. I don't think it has been settled yet, which is extraordinary. Mm. I should say, with regard to reparations, in 2015, a Reaper drone similar to the one used in Afghanistan, U.S. Reaper drone killed by mistake two men, one American, one an Italian, in Pakistan. President Obama apologized for that in 2016, and the Italian family was awarded $3 million in compensation for the death of their loved one. And so we've argued that the Ahmadi family should receive $3 million apiece for each person who was killed. Second part of this is with respect to accountability. Pentagon, as soon as they apologized and then released a report in which they totally excused themselves from any wrongdoing, they said, well, we made mistakes, but, you know, so that's the way it goes. We were given no information about the communications around that, you know, among the American elements of that attack, no information about the technology that was used, the mistake, why were the mistakes made, how could some innocent, really totally non-military person be in any way interpreted to have anything to do with Al-Qaeda or ISIS. None of these things were revealed, but as soon as the Pentagon said, we're absolving ourselves from any wrongdoing, the press turned their attention away from this, rather than demand answers to these very deep questions about who specifically was responsible for this, right, including what did President Biden do, when did he do it, was he ordering this to have happened regardless of what would go on. All these things are very, very important.
Right.
And that's what we should be demanding accountability for.
Exactly. I'm speaking to Nick Motern. He is a founder and participant and activist with No Drones, KNOWDrones.com, and BanKillerDrones.org. And I want our listeners to really understand the seriousness of this this explosion of drone technology. They call it the global defense drone market. In last year in Azerbaijan, they conquered almost the entire Armenian exclave of Nagorno-Karabakh. And then this year, there is a lot of pressure in Armenia as they are using drones against Russian separatists. So these armed drone systems are really spreading and creating all kinds of arms races on every level. Can you talk about more about the proliferation of military drones around the world and what your concerns are?
Yes, thank you really for asking that, because at this point, what the world has experienced in terms of drones has to do with drones the size of a Reaper drone, which is got a body like 36 feet long and wingspan 66 feet. Some larger ones, maybe up to 77 feet. These have been used for what they call targeted killing, for assassination, for assisting troops on the ground who are involved, obviously, in invasions for riches. And then there has been smaller drones used for surveillance by police, sometimes, for instance, in the chase in Gaza, where a small drone was sent by the Israeli Defense Forces into the apartment someone they wanted to kill to assure that he was there. Mm. And then they sent in a conventional aircraft with missiles to you know, kill him and family members in his apartment. So there are very small drones that are, one, that are being widely used up to the size of the Reaper drone. Turkey has become a successful drone manufacturer and sales nation. And the drones that you're talking about are Azerbaijan are drones made in Turkey, by and large. The Turks have also developed a drone, small, basically, they say guided by artificial intelligence, which means that the drone can identify human figures on, you know, in a target area, and they can fly at the human figures and explode before they get there, like flying hand grenades. And those, we know, have been used in Libya and may well be used in a conflict between Ukraine and Russia, which the United States seems to be wanting to have happen. Turkey's also selling somewhat larger drones to Ukraine. And I've heard a report saying Russia is, you know, putting drones into their battle line. But Russia has been not the foremost developer of drones, but more looking toward technology to thwart drones, to use electronics and other means to make them ineffective. And so what we have on the Russian-Ukraine border is an extremely dangerous situation where the temptation is to use drones because it doesn't involve human beings, but yet you can precipitate a much larger conflict. And this is, you know, what we can see, I think, having happened in many ways in Afghanistan in terms of extending the war.
Right.
There's another part to this that I wanted to mention. But go ahead with your question, Chris.
You know, I have too many questions for the 4 minutes we have left, so I'm going to let you go ahead. Because if you think something is most important to say, Nick Moturn, please focus there.
Okay. What's happening now is that the United States and China are the foremost developers of weaponized drones, and the artificial intelligence technology that will move to the point where these weapons can guide themselves to their supposed target and decide when to fire. The United States is moving drones into the Pacific now. The Marines are now getting access to them. And they have also put artificial intelligence into much larger aircraft, like F-16s. I heard a former general say that they have an F-16 now that, guided by artificial intelligence, can outmaneuver a manned F-16. This is a technology that will be put into large bombers. This is a very, very dangerous path that we're on in the midst of a global climate disaster, and we really need much more press coverage of what this is all about, because it's another world being developed, and a parallel world to our own that can be devastating.
Yeah, and you know, in terms of a ban, I just want to let our listeners know that this may seem difficult, but the landmines were banned, cluster bombs were banned, nuclear weapons are now banned, even though the large nuclear nations still have them. There is what's called a normative effect, and this is something that we all need to jump into. Like this arms race right now, China, India, Japan, Australia, in the Asian Pacific market, they're the fastest growing use of drones, and of course our country has really set the stage for this disaster. So once again, Nick Moturn, I wanted to get back to the ban. On your petition campaign, you have a list of demands for or things that you are asking for. Can you let our listeners know what those are?
Well, we have a petition on our website that people can sign that encourages a ban against weaponized drones, but we haven't really discussed the issue of police and military drone surveillance,
right,
which is also a very, very big problem. But if people go to the website bankillerdrones.org, there's a lot of detail, there's a lot of information, and I think it'll really help people, you know, come up to speed on what's happening right now.
And lastly, I wanted to ask you about drone whistleblowers. I think that, you know, a lot of people have moral injury who are drone pilots and people who work with drones. And tell us the case of Daniel Hale and what we can do to support him, and who is he?
Thank you very much. I forgot to mention that. Daniel Hale is in his early 30s. He released information through the Intercept website that really exposed the technical and analytical shortcomings of drone warfare. And it was a very thoroughgoing report. It's called The Drone Papers. You can read this at the Intercept. This was something that had the military taken seriously and understood what the shortcomings were, they wouldn't have kept going with the drone program, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. Things that he pointed out, or that were pointed out in the documents he released, came to pass in front of everybody's eyes on August 29th, the Amati attack. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to 44 months in federal prison for releasing these documents. He is now in Marion, federal prison in Marion, Illinois, in a maximum security and very restricted communication section. And instead of being given the Congressional Medal of Honor for his honesty and his conscience-driven courage, we have him in prison, and people who have perpetrated these things walking free and proud of it. And so if people want to support Daniel, which is very important, they can go to a website called standwithdanielhale.org.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to have to wrap it up, but I wanted you to hear my little announcement, because every month we protest at Beale Air Force Base. They do not have killer drones, but they have the targeting and surveillance drone that is part of this whole horrendous picture. So we are there every month, and we are going to be there December 14th from 3 to 5 at the Wheatland Gate. So go to our Facebook page, Occupy Beale Air Force Base. Nick Moturn, thank you so much for your work, and thank you always. When I've been at Creech Air Force Base protesting, you have been part of flooding the airways with advertisements, educating the population so that they focus more in on, otherwise we would get almost no coverage in that area. So your work precedes you, and I really appreciate you very much. Thank you for being my guest today. Thanks. On the Peace and
Thank
Justice
you.
Program. All right. Stay well, okay?
Thanks. You too. Right. Thanks so much.
Sure. Bye. All right. So I'm going to post the, in the archives, I always post the website. So if you didn't catch those, this is an extremely important issue. And while I was researching for this one, I found out more about, there's another one called Stop Killer Robots, and it's about AI, and is very also a very terrifying thing, that soon these things will be fully autonomous. Now we are so up a creek, so we must stop that also. So more on that at another time, but for now, bankillerdrones.org. So let's go on to another song, and this one is commemorating John Lennon's death on the 8th of December, 1980, with Imagine. Imagine.
only sky. Imagine all the people living for today. Imagine there's no countries. It isn't hard to do. Nothing to kill.
John Lennon. It still gives me goosebumps after all these years of hearing that song. So this is the Peace and Justice program. My name is Chris, and I am always grateful for my guests doing the incredible work, whether it's on a national, international scale, or right in our own community. And I have on the line with me Morgan Kennedy. She's a local community organizer and activist who is currently the spokesperson for a new group called Chico Voters. Morgan, welcome to the Peace and Justice Program.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Yeah, and, you know, Chico Voters kind of... We all kind of scratched our heads, like, who is Chico Voters? Who is it, Morgan Kennedy? What is this new group?
Chico Voters is a nonpartisan group of people that were extremely unsatisfied with the council leadership of Sean Morgan and Andrew Coolidge, and felt that if we did not organize together and do something about it, that our city that we love so much will really suffer in the remainder of their terms.
Yeah. So what I have written down here is, this is a quote, the council led by Coolidge and Morgan enforced unconstitutional ordinances and embroiled the city in a lawsuit that prevents us from enforcing any laws related to camping, while also refusing to provide basic services like trash containers and porta potties where people live, and the impact on our parks and waterways has been particularly devastating. Is that part of your concern?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think what we are seeing now is still very much the results of the catastrophic campfire in 2018.
Right.
You know, we had a whole community eliminated. A lot of that community was very low income. And then we already were less than 1% vacancy down here in Chico when that happened. And so people have nowhere to go. And though it's been 3 years and people with more resources and advantages have, you know, either moved out of the area or found some place to stay, there still is a significant portion of the population that has not found anywhere to go. And they are having to live in our parks and near our waterways. And human beings, no matter who they are, you know, they accumulate waste. And those people have nowhere to put their waste. You know, they have nowhere to go to the bathroom, and they're just doing their best to survive, especially during the winter months when weather is really harsh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's not only absolutely inhumane that those people have nowhere to go when there are several organizations in town who have come up with good solutions and they've just been hamstrung by this current council. You know, but it also really negatively impacts our parks and the natural beauty in our community.
Right. You know, the town seems like it has become totally unmoored. The things that we love about this town have fallen away because of this polarization. And there's this hatred that emerged on social media. And it seems like it goes back to people who profit from all of this. I mean, do you feel like there were political aims of a few that shaped this situation?
Oh, absolutely. Particularly our local far-right PAC, Citizens for a Safe Chico, or Safe Chico. They've changed their names a few times, so whatever it is currently, is particularly invested in keeping the members of our city feeling afraid and hopeless, because it really feeds their agenda. And then in turn, they get money for that. People give them money because they're saying that they're going to fix the problem, when in reality, they don't fix the problem. They just purchase city council members who will benefit them financially even further. So it's really quite a shame what has happened there.
Yeah. And so in the case of the city council, I felt like we really got a slam dunk. There was a pack called Safe Chico, right, that brought this current conservative majority into power. Who was behind that pack?
There are a few people, but most notably is probably Rob Berry. He is a former lawyer for PG&E who moved up here from the Bay Area, I'm assuming for retirement, and instead of retiring and enjoying our community, he has just made it his goal to really try to turn the city into what he wants it to be instead of what it was when he got here.
And does he have the support of officials in the North State higher than what's in Chico?
Oh, absolutely. He's made himself very cozy with our assemblymen and our congressmen. And our supervisors. He is extremely vocal online about what his opinions are, and they are really echoed by our government officials.
So part of what Chico Voters has done is to start a recall effort for Sean Morgan and the mayor, Coolidge. I was wondering if you could tell us what is the basis of the recall? You mentioned their horrible response to the unhoused situation, which came out of the government's shelter in place edict during COVID. What else are they doing that is particularly disturbing?
Well, I mean, there's a number of things. They have gotten us involved in lawsuits regarding our city's treatment of the unhoused that will, by the end, probably have cost well over $1 million to the city of Chico. Right. They have also, so that's one way they've been fiscally irresponsible. They've also really spit in the face of Paradise, our community that was devastated and is now trying to recover. A big source of income for Paradise businesses that are trying to reestablish themselves is the ice rink that they have at the Parks and Recreation Center, which attracts a lot of people from out of the area. And what does our city council do this year? They open up their own ice rink in downtown Plaza. And then we had just recently an article was published in the local paper that Paradise businesses are now suffering. They're not seeing the same, amount of guests or growth of income that they have in previous years. So we are literally taking away from our sister community that is trying to recover. And most of all, I think the biggest reason for this recall is that both of these council members ran under totally false pretenses. They ran under the pretense that they were going to be on council to represent the citizens of this community. And that doesn't mean that they just get to pick and choose who those citizens are. I believe especially Sean Morgan has been openly disrespectful and disdainful of reasonable members of this community who try to voice their concerns. He often accuses them of, you know, being terrorists or extremists, when really it's just people who have lived here their whole entire lives, who don't agree with his decisions. And as somebody who likes to brag that they've, you know, been on the council the longest out of any of the current serving members, he should know how to handle himself and how to interact with the citizens he is supposed to be representing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I like this last paragraph in the News and Review article that covered you under Newslines this week. It said, Morgan Kennedy, while defending herself and her cohorts against the notion they are extremists, expressed a sentiment, wanting the unhoused to be treated like human beings is not extreme. Wanting affordable housing is not extreme. Wanting a secure future for our children is not extreme. Amen to that. So, Morgan, one of the questions that people will have is, why a recall rather than waiting to vote these guys out when their terms expire?
Well, I think, because I am not particularly a huge fan of recalls. I believe recalls have been really weaponized by the far right over the last several years to try to eliminate people that they don't like. But I think that I really had to recall that recalls can either be a weapon or a tool. And the tool is there for citizens to use when there is really false representation in leadership or there is a detriment to their community. And I really believe, and our whole group really believes, that there are both of those things going on. You know, just in the first year of their terms, you know, just on one thing costing us, you know, over $1 million on a lawsuit, you know, that they were told would cost that much. You know, to me, that is that's a huge impact on our city. That's our roads not getting fixed. That's our schools not getting what they need. You know, that's our community members, you know, suffering, trying to find housing that they can afford, or people having to live on the streets, or our parks being damaged. Think about, you know, all the way, and that's just one instance of how many ways that amount of money could have benefited our community. And really, it was the fear of what sort of damage would be done in the next 3 years by them. If they've done so much catastrophic damage in the first year, then it was just time for us to use the tool that was available for what it was made for.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So another question I think listeners would like me to ask is about, will this recall effort cost the city a lot of money? Like, how does it pan out?
So our goal is to get on the June ballot, which is the supervisor's ballot. There will be a, you know, small number of people who are not in either supervisor's district who may fall into a city councilor's district, but the cost would be absolutely minimal. The only way that there will be a special election for this recall effort is if we continue to face the opposition that we have been facing from our city officials and county officials. But we have gone above and beyond to prove ourselves legitimate, and so I don't foresee that happening.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's important to people. So how do people get in touch with Chico voters if they're interested in participating in this recall?
Yeah, we have so many wonderful things set up right now. The best thing to do is to go to chicovoters.org. That's going to be our website that has just really all of our information on it. We also are really looking for people that live in these districts, you know, say they don't need outreach beforehand. They just want to sign. There are several options on there to either print it out and give us a call and we'll come pick it up. Or if you don't even want to print it out, we'll bring it over to you. If you want to volunteer with petition signing efforts, you can also find that information on our website. It's really, we put a lot of work into what we have available, and we're really proud of what we have. Mm-hmm. So definitely people should be checking out our website. You can also find us on Facebook. And on Facebook, we are Chico Voters. And again, our website is chicovoters.org.
So this is the Peace and Justice Program, and please stay tuned for Playing Dead at 1 o'clock. My name is Chris, and I have on the line with me Morgan Kennedy, who is the current spokesperson for Chico Voters, a new group that is focusing on a recall of Sean Morgan and Mayor Coolidge. Morgan Kennedy, I want to give you an opportunity to have any last words about this recall before we switch gears.
I think that this recall will be very successful. And I think that the candidates who will run to replace Coolidge and Morgan will do a much better job listening to people on both sides of the aisle and operating in a way that will benefit all of us instead of just a few.
Mm. Well, thank you for your efforts. It's important to be part of a democratic process that actually works for people rather than an oligarchy, for sure. You know, the thing I wanted to ask you about, the things that have been resonating for me this week and that you and I have talked about before here on community radio is about abortion rights. And this has been a difficult week. There's been a lot of kind of poignant anniversaries. There's been World AIDS Day on Wednesday. There's been this new variant of the COVID virus that has been shaking the world and creating havoc. And then the Supreme Court is looking at our abortion rights. And I was wondering if you wanted to weigh in on any of those topics.
Yeah, sure. You know, I myself happen to stand very left on the political spectrum. And I also spent a number of years working in healthcare. And I absolutely 100% believe that abortion is a healthcare. I mean, it's like, it's where do you begin? You know, it affects women physically, socioeconomically. It really, if women do not have the power to decide how many children they are going to have and when they are going to have them, we've essentially crippled over half of our population, you know, which is something I think that the far right would really like, you know, because the poorer you are, the less educated you are, the more desperate you are, the more you are able to be made afraid of things that you don't have exposure to, and the more you can be persuaded to vote against your own best interests. So I think that it's really all this is about is creating a whole new generation of really desperate and suffering people who will vote Republican, which I think is really disgusting.
Sorry, I had my mic turned down. You know, it's alarming to me, too, the way people vote against their own interests. And, it's very distressing to even consider, you know, at my age, I was a youth before 1973 and know what women went through when abortion was illegal. And it is absolutely terrifying to think of women losing rights to control their own bodies. And the way that some of this might be taken up in the Supreme Court might affect other privacy issues also, including birth control and other health care. And I just really want to encourage you to, you know, if you have anything more to say on this, because our listeners, you know, need perspective of people who are advocates. I think it's too infrequently discussed because it's one of these things that people keep really close to themselves. People don't say, I had an abortion and this was my experience, you know, or, you know, it just more and more feminists are starting to do that because they recognize how important it is to normalize abortion care as health care. But anything else you want to say, Morgan Kennedy, about this topic?
Yeah, I would say that during this time of year in particular, I think about my youngest daughter. Her name was Emerald, and we were very much anticipating her arrival when I was 22 weeks pregnant. I found out, both me and my husband found out during an ultrasound, that she had a fatal heart defect, and essentially the only reason that she was currently living was because my body, my heart, was doing the work for her system. And we were faced with two choices, and the two choices were to continue to term, and I would give birth to her, and she would suffocate to death, essentially because her body could not make oxygen. It was a whole long thing, but she would suffocate to death, but it would be slow, anywhere from one day after she was born to it could be up to 3 weeks after she was born. Or we could choose to terminate the pregnancy at that stage. And I really had wanted nothing more than to have her and hold her and do all these things. But really, after some talking with my husband, it was looking at the fact that I would be serving my own wants and needs. He would be serving his own wants and needs, but our child would suffer a very painful and prolonged death. And we loved her so much that we could not subject her to that. So we did end up we made the decision to terminate our pregnancy, and that was in 2013. That dramatically impacted my life. And has made me a very vocal advocate for a woman's right to choose. I think people really like to look at the issue of especially later term abortions and think that it's just some lazy or cruel woman who is just has changed her mind, you know, 2/3 of a way through pregnancy, when really that is not the fact at all. The vast majority of women who get an abortion after 12 weeks are doing so for medical reasons. Either their health is at dire risk, or in our case, the child that they are carrying is severely disabled and will suffer an immeasurable amount of pain. I think, you know, most mothers would not want to put that fate on their child if they can. And so really, you know, when all this stuff is coming up about later term abortions, I not only think of the women who will no longer have a choice of what medical treatments they want to provide for their children with disabilities, but I also think about just the amount of pain and suffering that is going to cause these children should these services no longer be available. And it just makes me so sad. I was so grateful that I had a choice to end her life in a very humane, quick manner, as opposed to sitting there and watching her just struggle to breathe for what could have been weeks at a time. To me, that was a much more caring and compassionate and loving thing to do for my child than it would have been if I hadn't had a choice at all. I think the far right, or, you know, people who are really highly concerned about these children, they don't like women like me, and they don't like me talking about what the reality of these situations are. They want to preach over and over that people, you know, we should have less government involvement. But at the end of the day, these decisions are literally telling mothers and fathers what sort of medical treatment they can and cannot have for their children, and what they can and cannot have for themselves. If that is not extreme government overreach, then I really don't know what is.
Yeah. And I, once again, I'm sorry to have to ask you to tell the story of that late-term abortion and the loss of your daughter, Emerald. I'm very, you know, it's just so heart-wrenching. And I appreciate very much your sharing it, because I know it hurts to tell the story, but it's so important. And I want to thank you, Morgan Kennedy, for all of your work, you know, with Chico Voters and everything you've been doing. I know that you're very, very active in with your family at this point. And anyway, I'm sending you lots of love across the airwaves. Thank you for being my guest today.
Thank you so much, Chris. I appreciate it.
All right. Peace to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, stay tuned for Playing Dead, as I said, and get involved where you can. I want to just let you know a couple of things. When Morgan Kennedy was speaking, it came up to me to tell you about Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter will be happening again this year, as it has for the last, I think, 9 years, where during the cold months, unhoused people are able to get in out of the cold and the wet. And that will be taking place in from December to February, and volunteers are needed. And so that you'll have to go online to find the volunteer schedule, but it's Chico Safe Space Winter Shelter. The other thing I wanted to let you know about, we were talking about abortion rights, and there's an activist group in town. If you're interested in getting involved with defending reproductive rights, and they're called WORD, Women on Reproductive Defense, and think you can find it on Facebook, but hopefully online also. So that is another one I wanted to share with you. And stay tuned once again for Playing Dead and for this wonderful Friday afternoon lineup that we bring you here at KZFR, so you can unwind from your week. And I want to thank KZFR for allowing this program to continue with all these important issues and people that really bring a lot of meaning, I think, to me and to others. So I'd like to thank some underwriters before I leave the chair, which Ray always pulls out from under me. He's laughing. I'd like to thank Paradise Community Guilds, fostering community by nurturing creativity, practicing stewardship of nature, and promoting values of sustainability. Paradise Community Guilds invites all people of goodwill and community spirit to help carry out that intent. To get involved, visit paradiseguilds.org, also on Facebook and at 762-1490. I'd also like to thank ChicoCallCenter.com. Employing locally since 1999, Chico Call Center is rapidly expanding and is now hiring new employees for their Nord Avenue location. Chico Call Center works with over 200 newspapers nationwide, renewing customer subscriptions. Compensation packages include hourly commission and nightly cash payouts. More information by visiting ChicoCallCenter.com. And so let me get out of here with the community calendar, and I hope you all have peace this week and enjoy this beautiful scary weather. Here we go.
You're tuned in to KZFR Chico, and it's time for the KZFR Community Calendar. To have an event listed on the community calendar, send us an email to cc@kzfr.org. What many people do not know is that an estimated 50% of Chico State students, that's close to 8,000 students, suffer from low to very low food security. The Chico State Basic Needs Program, which operates the Hungry Wildcat Food Pantry, is open Monday through Friday from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. or by appointment for Chico State students in need of basic subsidies. The Chico State Basic Needs Program is accepting donations of items for their food pantry for this holiday season. For more information, you can call 530-898-4098. Starting at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, December 1st, vendors and music will fill the streets of downtown Gridley for the Winter Wonderland Festival and Light Parade. The parade itself starts at 6:30, and it's going to be running down Hazel Street. For more information, You can go on to Facebook and search the Winter Wonderland Festival and Light Parade. Keeping it festive through the weekend, the Orville tree lighting is going down at Montgomery and Myers Street on Friday, December 3rd. It's a tree lighting and small business holiday event featuring carriage rides and treats in downtown Oroville. And keeping the lights going all the way up Highway 70 and 99, it's the tree lighting at the Chico Downtown Plaza starting at 6 p.m. Festive music, an appearance by Santa, and a countdown to light the 2,000-plus LED tree in the plaza. Coming up on December 4th, it's a pop-up show that I think you'll love. The You'll Love Pop-Up, featuring six local artists on December 4th from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at 843 Calusa Street in Chico. Thanks for tuning in to the KZFR Community Calendar. You can hear the Community Calendar Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. and at 1 p.m. Stay streaming kzfr.org and don't touch that dial.
That's right, don't touch that dial. Thanks for tuning in. My name's Ray Lager. I'll be your host today here on Playing Dead, Music of the Grateful Dead, every Friday afternoon from 1 till 3. Nice day up here in NorCal. Back to a little bit more winter, late fall weather, but still beautiful and sunny out. And it's just not going to hit, you know, high 70s or mid-70s this time, but that's okay because we're digging it. And I hope it is beautiful wherever you are and catching us. On KZFR.org, or if you got that app on your phone, that's the way to go, man. Take it anywhere you get a signal. Syncs right up, you know, and all that groovy stuff.